This is Paul Burton, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 12th of July, 2013. Paul Burton, Part 2. Whilst you were based at Adelaide Island, you had one or two unexpected situations arise, which involved you having to go to Fossil Bluff.
Yeah. Unfortunately, at Fossil Bluff, there were two people who got injured. Well, one broke his leg and one was... developed some form of, I think, kidney problems, O'Donovan. And how it was decided, I don't know, but at the end of the day, the Argentinians flew in. I think they had their aircraft wintered at Adelaide Island or in the Antarctic, and they flew down. And my recollection is that there was a pilot, co-pilot, a mechanic... came in to Adelaide, and when he got there, it was decided that I would fly down with him and replace the two people. Who's put my name forward, or how my name got on the list, I don't know. But probably because on the base there was a cook, there was a radio operator, there was met men, builder could be replaced or managed without. Yeah. So I got the opportunity to fly down. But the pilot was very mindful that he got this huge toolbox and an extra person. So he said that the mechanic had to stay behind and the toolbox had to stay behind because he knew he was bringing two other people out.
So he'd be concerned about being overloaded.
Overloaded. And that's all he kept saying in his broken English. Overload, overload, overload. So there was, as far as I remember, there was a pilot, co-pilot and myself. Who flew down. Now, I'd flown down once before with Bass planes to take some equipment or take some mail down or do something. I think it was Bert Conch I flew down with. But didn't particularly know where it was. You know, it was just Fossil Bluff. and it was bad weather, shocking weather. And we flew down and he turned round and said, "Where is Fossil Bluff? Where is it?" And I said, "I've only been once before." And fortunately, as we said that, there was a bit of break in the cloud and like a hole in the cloud. And he just, and I actually saw the hut. And he just said, "Right, okay." And we just, "Where's the airstrip?" Well, there is no airstrip. And he just landed. And I think that's probably the most airing thing I've done in my life. I think it was a single engine Porter or whatever it was, small aircraft, and we landed. And there were two people to get out, who was one with a broken leg and one seriously ill.
It was somebody called Walker. Had
Dick Walker,
leg.
Yeah.
Dick Walker,
yeah,
broken
yeah,
leg, and yeah. O'Donovan with the stomach problem.
Yeah. Well, Dick Walker had been to Halley as well, and I can't remember when he went to Halley. I think it was after... Must have been before. Must have been before.
How did you get them out?
Well, they were back on the base. They'd managed to get them. The two other lads who were there, Ian and...
Don't worry.
Yeah. And they got them back onto base. But in those days, Bass didn't actually change their first aid kits. They were just, once they got to base, they stayed at base. Mm. So the plaster cast they put on just were crumbling and whatever. So eventually they got them out.
Out of date, you mean? Plaster was out of date?
Out of date, yeah. Yeah. After that, they then went on to replace the medical equipment every 12 months. I think that was the start of where they thought it was, you know, it proved a point. So eventually we got them into the aircraft and they flew away. Whatever happened to them after that, I do know that, but you know, they went on and went on to Argentina.
So have you been able to bring your personal box down with you to Fossil Bluff?
No, I just stayed.
And did you know how long you were going to be there for?
No, no.
So it was a real, you put your trust in Bass then, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, again, spirit of adventure. If you can help, you can help. And I wasn't there very long at Fossil Bluff with these two surveyors. Glaciologists, before there was an emergency went up and some dog sledge teams in the field had had a problem and tents had got blown away or whatever. So I can remember getting this, there was a bit old, an old thing, for a better word, a caboose, a box on a sledge. And I sort of strengthened that and recovered it and put a door on, and we got provisions into that so we could keep going 24 hours a day. And we set off to help and took equipment out with us for these two, these dog teams in the
field.
Whereabouts
were they?
To be honest, and this is where I keep failing, I've forgotten.
All right.
I've just forgotten.
It somewhere was, in King George's 6th.
Yeah. When we got to them, there was other dog teams actually there as well, had gone to the rescue. But there was a chappie ill who was a dog team driver. And I actually took his dog team and he came back with the tractors back to Fossil Bluff. So I wasn't at Fossil Bluff all that long. And then took a dog team, and there was two dog teams, two dog drivers and a surveyor, which was Miles Mosley, who unfortunately got killed in the Antarctic. And Tim Christie was a surveyor. And again, another episode to my sort of time in the Antarctic.
One of the points you make is that you seem to have profited by Ella Fid's misfortune.
I did.
Not profited, but benefited.
Yeah, benefited. Yeah, yeah. Which, to a certain extent, used to play heavy on my mind. You think, somebody's misfortune is my fortune. End of the day, I felt sorry for the people who were ill, but just took advantage of the opportunity and enjoyed every second of it.
Tell me about this surveyor, Tim Christie, who you work from out of Stonington.
Well, I met Tim in the field. He was from Stonington, but I met him in the field. Who was a great guy. His father... I don't know if I should tell you this, but his father was a brigadier you know the newsletters we get?
Yes.
You know, when you're in the field, the radio operator will come on and say, I've got your newsletter from home. Do you want me to read it out? So if you say yes, you say, just move up a couple of megs. So as you move up to keep the radio or airways free, you could hear everybody else who's camping, they'd move up and listen to it. It's just news, that's what you wanted. He'd read Tim's newsletter out, and it'd be a case of... because his father was a brigadier. You know, your father's been playing croquet on the lawn with someone or been to some army function or whatever.
Lord and lady somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. It was always a hierarchy.
Yeah.
And mine would be, your dad's gone to the pit on nights. So the difference, you know. And then you got Miles Mosley, who I think Miles came from Manchester. Another character. But Tim was just—he was just brilliant.
Did he have a nickname?
Miles or Tim?
No, Tim. Was he not nicknamed Twim?
Twim, that's right. Yeah,
because of his accent.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He got a very prim and proper accent.
And tell me about surveying with Tim.
Well, there lies a story. He used to always wear his clothing and that, and we were using what we used to call telerometer. You know, sending signals from one station to another. Paul Gerling, who I got to know, he'd be on one another mountain and we'd set off and Tim would have all his equipment and whatever and I'd be carrying the telerometer. And he'd get warm, he's walking up this mountain and he'd take his hat off and put it in his pocket, and a couple of paces further on his hat would fall out of his pocket. I'd pick that up, he'd take his gloves off, put them in his pocket. Few more paces, they'd fall out of his pocket, I'd pick them up and move on. By the time he got to the top of the mountain, everything he'd taken off and put in his pocket, I'd hand them back to him. I'd say, here's your hat. He'd say, hey, thank you, Paul, thank you. And then, so one time, it was a nice day, we were setting the telerometer up, decided he was going to take his anorak off, pulled his anorak off, and pulled it and hit the telerometer. And the telerometer just boing, boing, boing all the way back down the mountain. And he just looked at it and he just went, oh, and swore. And I thought, well, if that's supposed to be swearing, it's not like I can swear. It sounded so polite. But that's typical Tim. Just great guy, great guy. Tim and... he knew his job, but Tim was a typical person who, I don't know where he got his life skills from, because sometimes they didn't meet, his life skills and reality just didn't match. They just didn't match. But, you know, another world and another person I enjoyed being in, and another person I learnt a lot from.
Another social strata, all of which, of course, is rather ironed out in the Antarctic.
Yeah, it is, very much so. Yeah. You know, I can always remember Miles. When I met Miles, I said to him, you know, I'm Paul Burton, what's your name? He said, Miles Mosley. And I'd never heard of Mosley. And I thought, Mosley, is he not Mosley? So I said to him, how do you spell it? So he spelled it. I says, that's not Mosley, that's Mosley. He says, no, it's not. I said, of course it's Mosley. He says, no, my mum don't like that. But typical Yorkshireman looking at the basics.
So, yeah, yeah. But, talking about basics, I mean, need to pick up a couple of stories about you and toilets at Halley.
There's
a turdicle.
The turdicle, the magical turdicle. Yeah. It's just something that happened, you know. It was a pit that was dug initially when they built the base. It was like a letter T upside down, and I think they thought it would last forever, but in a few years all these men filled it, and in winter the turdicle used to freeze, and it used to grow like a pyramid upside down. Well, like a pyramid.
Stalagmite,
yeah. And it was my job, I suppose, as the builder, as the repairman, as the plumber, to go down. And we used to go through the, down the, take, move the, it was a 5 gallon oil can, I think, move that, go down the hole in the floorboards on an electron ladder. And it was all frozen. Go down with the felling axe and chop it down. And chop the turdicle down. And it was like a big adventure. I used to laugh because I used to say, you can see the curry layers.
Well, the curry knife.
Yeah. And in summer, it would just all melt down. There was never no smell, anything like that. You know, I suppose being a plumber, I'm used to seeing that situation. But some chaps couldn't cope with the thought of going down and the thought of whatever it was. It just didn't bother me. It was just another job. So
did it never fill up completely?
It did. And, well, it was filling up. It didn't actually come level with the floor, but it was filling up. And, I kept saying, it's not going to last. It's not going to last. So then it was decided we'd dig another toilet behind.
Start again,
yeah. So we took the back of the toilet out and dug another one. And that could have been quite a dangerous situation because his intention was to dig it, but it was setting up some form of a pulley system to get rid of the snow we dug, so it had to be brought up into the toilet, through the toilet, through the tunnel of the building to the far end, to the gash ramp, and then taken out and dispersed onto the snow outside. So it was a major issue, and unfortunately one time, I'm not supposed to have short to say this, but I got up, came out, and I think it's because I wanted to go to the toilet, and decided I would be lowered down in a bit of a bucket. Got inside the bucket, and the bucket turned upside down, and I fell down. And I think it was about 4 metres. And fortunately, I just missed a pickaxe, which had been actually dropped into the snow, and one piece was sticking up of the pickaxe. So, you know, another 12 inch and I could have been implanted onto a pickaxe. So I think that was probably
the nearest
thing to danger.
Yeah. Did you ever fear for your life in the Antarctic? Were you ever in a situation where you thought you might not come out?
Well, I suppose it's things like pass through your mind, you know, when you're in the field and you're crossing crevasses and things like that. But some crevasses are small, some crevasses are huge. I think one of the scary ones as well, what I can remember, was with the tractors at Halley, out with Dave Peel, because those were huge. Mm. But, you know, you learn to move on, don't you? I think there's other fids being in far scarier positions, you know. Mm.
And what about situations that made you laugh out loud?
Oh, lots of them. I wasn't there, but I can always remember listening to it. I think it was the radio operator on the Argentine islands. His girlfriend had packed in with him, and she'd sent him this Dear John. And he was one who did, he was like a ham person on with radio. He talked to other stations. And she'd wrote him this letter that she was packing him in because love wasn't a basis of marriage and had nothing in common except each other. So she was called it a day with him. And I wasn't there, but I always, you know, that was a chuckle. I thought that was quite funny. But
Miles Mosley was asking the radio operator about Interflora.
Miles and in his naivety, shall we say, had sent some flowers to his mum or to someone and then realised that they were gone away on holiday. So he phoned the radio operator and I think it was Adelaide he phoned. Used a radio. And he said to the radio op, "What happens to flowers when they're delivered by Interflora and there's nobody there to receive them?" Well, it went all quiet. And suddenly this voice came back and said, "They die."
I was amazed. You're not the first person to mention sending flowers. I was amazed that you could, in the Antarctic, actually send flowers to an address in Britain. How did you go about it?
I think you sent your message to the radio operator, and then I think they went to Stanley. And then I think it was Interflora then. Because I always remember Dave Peel, because Dave Peel was a married man when he came down. And he remembered his wife's birthday or anniversary or whatever and sent her some orchids. And then got told by newsletter or whatever, "Thank you for the orchid." And he thought he was sending a lot of orchids because he'd spent an arm and a leg and she got one. you know, in them days, probably £10, which was a lot of money. And she got one orchid.
£10. The money would just be taken out of your account.
I'll take out of your account, yeah.
Were there many Dear John letters? And if so, how did the base kind of get a well, support the victim?
Yeah, I don't know if it was on Adelaide or on Argentine Islands, but there was a chink stick somewhere, and I remember seeing this chink stick.
A what?
A ching. When a chap got a Dear John, there was this... they called it a ching stick. What it was an old boot with a broom handle in it, filled, and the boot was filled with concrete. And then nailed to the broom handle, it was all beer bottle tops. And as you banged it, you went ching, ching, ching.
Percussion instrument.
Yeah. And they used to put this girlfriend's photograph on the dartboard. And then you get the darts. And obviously by this time you're... you know, worse for wear of drink, and you'd kill her with the darts. You'd throw the darts at a photograph and you'd kill her. And then you'd put the ching stick under your arm or against your arm, like a gun, this boot, and then you'd run and hit the dartboard and sort of knock seven bells out of this girlfriend you'd just had. And quite a few of them who were drunk. The story goes that the ching stick had hit them that hard on the like a reaction from a firing a gun, and it had catapulted them miles down the middle of the base type thing. So,
was there ever any case of a more sensitive approach to the poor chap?
Not really. It was tough luck, mate.
Oh, yes, I suppose so. At South George, you played around with a flag mast.
Oh.
I'm told.
Ricky Chin. Oh, how sad. We lost a good man, we lost Ricky Chin.
He was base commander at the time at South Georgia.
Yeah, he'd been base commander, Halibay, South Georgia. That was the summer when I... that was in 69. And he was... I thought I was a person of traditions, but he liked the flag to go up at a certain time in the morning, come down a certain time at night. And one day, somebody hadn't put the flag up, and he was, you know, he wasn't a happy chappy, shall we say. So I volunteered to go and put the flag up, and I took his windproof trousers. Well, I don't know if you've ever seen windproof trousers; they're usually orange or bright colour. And so I actually fastened his windproof trousers to the thing, and I hoisted the not the flag, but his windproof trousers. And it was a windy day, and they were blowing in the wind superb. Well, when he saw them, oh, did he go mad. I got a good roasting.
Not a serious one?
No, no. Well, Ricky could give you a serious telling off, and then next minute he was your best pal. Oh, right. That's the nature of what he was.
Did he have to replace him with a proper...
I was told to go take him down and put the flag up. And then there was another time, sorry I'm putting in, but there's another time. We used to have smoko. This is, again, at South Georgia. Well, there was... you could, because this building was on stilts, you could go down under the stilts, which was a door entrance, and there was a boiler house, and there was a drying room. There were these heating pipes that went round, and we used to go in there, take his boots off, take his windproofs and whatever we were wearing before we went upstairs into the room to keep the place clean and tidy and dried your equipment. So smoko time. We all went into the drying room, took boots off, and we used to actually drop as windproofs and step out of them, out of his boots and out as windproofs, so we could step back into them. And one day I thought, well, we'll have a bit of a laugh here. So I tied everybody's boots together all around the... I can't remember if I tied them together or around the pipes. And there was Golly, there was Dad, there was Fanny. There was quite a few. And, of course, we all rushed down. So I says, come on, we've got to get back to work. Rushed into the boiler house, they stepped in, and of course, went no further. And there's a big pile of fids on there. Did I pay for that?
In what way was the recompense?
Oh, they got back it in other ways. One minute I was finding something. I mean, I were all the way down, right down at the jetty, and somebody said I had to go up to the see Ricky Chin up at the house. When I went to Ricky, Ricky'd obviously been told and kept me waiting or kept me hanging around. And it was just people to get their own back and things.
It's the sort of humour that we're talking about is the stuff you read about in boys' books about boys.
Oh, yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Dormitory, japes in the dorm.
Typical. But it was clean fun and it was good fun. Yeah. You know, and it's just...
And was humour vital? Humour important?
Oh, yeah. A laugh a day makes you feel better.
What happened at the end of your period at Adelaide Island? You were there for a year?
Yeah, then I came out and I went into South America. And what I did, I got off. When it came out of Adelaide, and it had called at different places on the way back, on its way back to England, I got off the ship in Montevideo, spent 7 months in South America, just roaming South America, and then re-caught the ship back in Montevideo. That's not as easy as it sounds, because you're to be in contact with the agent, Batter's agent in Montevideo, saying, when is the ship coming? Ah, no problem, mañana. And you think, am I going to miss this ship or what? You know, now I can remember I was in Santiago, Chile, and I phoned, and I wasn't the best with Spanish. But he wasn't the best with English. And it was a case of, it's coming in tomorrow. And I had to get from Santiago, Chile, over to Montevideo. So I had to get through Chile, over the Andes, through Argentina, into Montevideo in 24 hours. Unfortunately, I did it.
Well, on the surface?
On the buses. Yeah, coaches. I did it, yeah. And it was, going over the Andes was fantastic.
Tell me.
Oh, just... well, the Spanish is muy lindo, beautiful. It was absolutely fantastic, and it was around about the time when the rugby players playing. Can you remember they made a film and a book and they ate each other. The plane came down and survived. They had to eat human flesh. It was around about that time, and I didn't know until I actually read the book and.
That would have been a separate sailing. You got off the boat on one trip and picked up again on a later trip.
Yeah.
So a separate sailing.
Yeah.
Not the same sailing.
No. So when I got off, the ship...
Did a round trip.
Yeah, went back to England, refurbished, re-equipped, and came back down, going for the summer season.
Yeah.
And I re-caught it and went back. And actually, when I caught it, it was going back to Halley to rebuild Halley.
So did you do that?
Yeah, Yeah, I'd organised for me to go back before I got off.
Right.
So.
So you did another season at Halley.
Another summer.
Halley 3.
Halley 3, yeah, in the Armco. Yeah.
How was that?
It was a good season. It was hard work. It was 12-hour shifts, you know. But what happened? The boat went down, anchored off, or anchored alongside. And I think we did 12-hour shifts. And literally built the Armco, put the buildings inside. Big Al was the chap in charge of the programme, Al Smith.
Was it hard work? Was it difficult?
Life's what you make it, isn't it? You know, I suppose anybody would say working in the Antarctic is difficult. You're working with the conditions, you're working with what's there. But to a certain extent, you get on with it.
Well, this design that Alan Smith produced was quite revolutionary.
You were
doing something brand new.
Yeah, well, one of the good things, I'm not quite sure it proved a success or not, but we built the Armco and then we used pulverized fuel ash. It's just clinker. And we laid that inside the Armco and bedded it down to get a level surface, because the Armco is like an egg.
Yeah, it's made of steel.
Made of steel, corrugated. So that we got the pulverised fuel ash, which was all pre-bagged, got that in, and then put timbers on top of that, and then built the sectional buildings inside the Armco. I can't remember how many buildings there were, but we built the generator shed quite away from the main living and offices and scientific laboratory accommodation, purely from point of view of safety, vibrating. Mm. And if it went, it was all right.
So it's almost like an underground high street, was it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. All connected with tunnels, yeah. And again, it might have been, we played out, we worked out, but we had good fun and we had some silly times. And I can remember again I think we had to lift a crane off the ship. And there was a few hairy moments that I think the... It almost went into the sea and it scraped the side of the ship, and I think the ship was white and got red marks on it from the crane. And just, it was life, you know. I can't remember what we did and what we didn't do, but we had a short time to build the base. As I say, it was 12 on, 12 off. I think we used to come back to the ship and sleep on the ship. But I can remember one time on the ship, the ice cliffs gave way, and I was on board. It was a bit of a scary moment. I think we were in bed or watching a film or something. The boat itself is tied alongside, and there's obviously crew watching for danger all the time. And it flattened the actual bulkhead of the ship walking down the sides. It flattened some of that, came through a couple of portholes.
The cliff just collapsed onto the boat?
Yeah, yeah.
You know. And it broke through portholes?
Yeah, yeah. Fortunately, to the crewmen, they cut the ropes very quickly, and the boat went out to sea, sorted itself out, and eventually slowly came back inside. But I also remember one time with a load of sea ice, and the boat came alongside the sea ice. And it all broke up. All the sea ice broke up. And I think we lost a couple of sledges. And they had to pick men off the sea ice and take them onto the boat. So you were always mindful of that sort of danger. I can remember one time, there's a chap who I got on with very well. He was a beastie man at Halley Bay, John Knuckles.
John?
Knuckles.
Knuckles, yeah. Yeah.
He was a bit of an experimenter, and he used to like to make things, and he was quite ingenious, really. And he built this grabber, and we went onto the sea ice and drilled a hole in the sea ice, and he used to drop this grab effect thing down to the seabed, scrape the seabed and wind it up. And we were on the sea ice one time, just myself and him and a skidoo with this machine he developed. And suddenly we heard this loud... And the sea ice gave way, and a massive, massive crack. And fortunately, the skidoo was on the right side of the crack. We were on the wrong side, and we had to jump. And it was probably 2 foot, 2 foot six gap, and the sea ice was breaking up and it was going out. That, again, could have been a hairy situation, because I don't think we had a radio. There was two men, and, you know, obviously on base they knew where we'd gone, but it would have been too late then. So,
as a result of these near misses, were there any changes to procedures or regulations or rules or practices?
Yeah, I suppose there are. But a lot of the near misses, unless they get reported, nobody knows about them, you know. I think, you know, we're all more mindful of health and safety now than we've ever been. But in those days, I think all fellas that went to Antarctica got some form of spirit adventure in them. Mm. You know, now to go in the field, because it's so expensive, so you have to have a reason why and a damn good programme to go. Lots of fellas, you know, went into the field, experienced dogs, experienced tractors, just for a jolly. And that's what it was about.
But do you remember any occasions where a base leader would call you all together and say, right, we had a close shave yesterday, this is how we do it from now on?
Yeah, I think Dick Scoffham was a particular one at Adelaide. We had a couple of near misses with aircraft and barrels, oil barrels and things like that.
But left out on the...
Yeah.
Oil barrels left out on the
landing
area.
And I can't remember what happened. I think somebody got hurt one time. Dick Scoffham, man, he's knew about health and safety. He was the worst man in the wonder world, because I think he's lost fingers. He lives in Canada and he has a farm in Canada. And he always played, he's like his combined harvester or whatever vehicle he was using, never turned them off. And I think he's lost, you know, he's paid his price by, he's lost two or three fingers. So
did you finish working on Halley 3, or was that still incomplete when you came out?
No, there was builders. I think there might have been a team of three or four or five builders left to winter to finish it off.
But you came out?
I came out. I only went in for a summer.
Did you have any plans at that point to return to the Antarctic?
A bit of yes and a bit of no. I enjoyed every second of being there. And I felt... I'd had a letter from somebody who said they'd gone to Saudi, who was a plumber, and earning mega bucks in Saudi. And I thought, well, I wouldn't mind giving that a go. For a, you know, a 6 month season or whatever, so I went back to UK, and I can't remember what really happened, but I think whether it was Bill Sloman or whatever, I got invited to join the. There was an aircraft and a pilot, Bert Conshy, plus a surveyor, Paul Gerlin. Loaned to the Americans, and I was invited to go as a field assistant, and I can't remember how it came about, but when I heard I was offered the opportunity, I grabbed it with both hands, and it was a case we flew out to I don't know how the plane got down there, I can't remember, but Bert had probably flown it down from somewhere.
Did you fly into the Antarctic?
Yeah, but we flew with the Americans. We flew to America. Paul and myself flew to America to meet the team who we were. Bob Thomas is an Englishman, and it was his programme, and he'd been to the Antarctic on FIDS, or BASS, as it was, and he'd gone to live in America or whatever he was doing, and he was running a programme for the Americans. So whether it was him who got this programme and this exchange or what was going across there, I don't know. But we went. We flew then down, we went onto a military base and flew from a military base down to New Zealand in a Charlie 130, Herkibird, and then to Christchurch, and then from Christchurch to McMurdo, and onto McMurdo. We actually worked on the Ross Ice Shelf.
Was it a different culture, culture?
No comparison.
Tell me about that.
Well, there was three groups. There was the scientists, there was military, and there was a company called Holmes and Narva, I think it was, who was the support staff. And it was a bit like neither three should meet or integrate. The military was very much, they kept themselves. Scientists kept themselves. And Holmes and Narva staff. I always remember we had a cook, a black guy, and he used to call me the honky. Hi, honky. And the building we slept in at McMurdo, he used to call it the Honky Chateau. But when we were out there,
John Trank, wasn't it?
Quite a guy. What a guy! No, the living accommodation was just, they weren't tents. They were, it was a blow up type dormitory, food was just, I've never had food like it. You know, food on Bath was, I've never complained about it, but you know, at Halley we had fresh meat once a week. There with Americans, you could, it were a case of help yourself, but don't take too much of the ice cream. You know, it was just, it's no comparison. And there, one of the things I've really felt strongly about was the equipment we had to go in the field with. It was virtually non-existent. In fact, there's a photograph on my wall there. We used to sleep on mattresses in the field. You know, when we were British Antarctic Survey, we had blow-up airbeds, which were far superb. Sheepskin, almost like sheepskin rugs on top of them, and then we'd sleep on top of that. But with the Americans, there'd nothing. It was just, it was toy town. They had no concept of field party work.
Who didn't?
The Americans. It was just a case, you go in the field, you'll only be there for a couple hours. But it didn't work like that. You know, you needed some form of emergency rations, you needed some form of emergency equipment. The tent we had, well, it would have shredded itself. But that's all they had, so it was a case, that's all we got.
So let me get this right then. You were going out to the field for a few hours.
Yeah.
Therefore you didn't need much.
Yeah.
Unless, of course, you got stuck.
Yeah.
In which case you had nothing.
Did nothing. And we experienced that one time, Paul Gurley and myself. The idea of the programme was we were doing about 3 to 5 drops per day where the aircraft would come in, drop us in one point. We'd do satellite triangulations and Paul would use the theodolite and take measurements. He'd radio again, the aircraft would come in, pick us up, move us to another position. And we do that 3 or 4 or 5 times a day. Now, one time, we were dropped off and we were there. We knew bad weather were coming in. Now, bad weather came in and I think we were there for about 4 or 5 days. Very little provision. We thought it was due to bad weather. When Bert eventually came back to us, there was something wrong with the satellite navigation equipment and they were actually looking for us and we didn't know that.
You were lost, were you?
We were lost, but they'd lost us. Now, we got the radio, but the radio had died down by then and we'd nothing to charge the radio up with. You know, it was toy town equipment. The best thing about it was the equipment, the best thing we had was the equipment that we took with us.
Bad stuff.
Yeah.
So on base was fine, but off base was dodgy.
Oh, yeah. Just.
That's very interesting. I hadn't heard that before.
It's.
But were you able to protest and say, hang on a second, it's too risky? Or?
No, we just got
out.
Got on with the job. Paul's a bit like me. So.
But this is where you were told you were due to be picked up on the Ross Ice Shelf, weren't you?
That's right, yeah.
So tell me a bit more detail about that process where you were expecting to be picked up and weren't.
Well, as I say, we were dropped off. Bert Conchie worked for British Antarctic Survey and he knew what Bass was about because he'd been down there, I don't know how many summers, and he knew the situation. And he used to shake his head thinking, dear me, the equipment we've got is minimal. So he'd always try to pick us up when he said he did. And one time, we'd been dropped off. But I presume Bert had gone back to do something else with Bob Thomas. Now, whether it was the actual machine on the aircraft that had malfunctioned, I don't know. But all we got told, but bad weather had come in, so we assumed bad weather and aircraft couldn't fly. Mm. Eventually, I think it was probably 4, 5, 6 days, I can't remember when, we got picked up. and said to Bert, you know, we were talking. He said, well, actually, we've been looking for you, which we didn't know. Paul Gerling didn't know, you know. And again, what made it worse was the radio. The radio was, it had gone dead. We'd nothing to charge or we'd know. Because we'd only gone out intensely for 3-4 hours.
Bass would never allow that, would
they? No, not at all. So, no, you know.
That put you off the Americans?
Well, I used to, in one sense, yes, but in another sense, no, because they were such wonderful people. And, you know, you get back to the station where you were, you looked at the equipment that was there. You put it down to another part of life.
And you got to the South Pole with him.
I was very fortunate, and I don't know how it all came about, but we were at McMurdo, and Paul was engaged doing something else, and I asked Bob Thomas. There was an opportunity to go, and I thought, if there's an opportunity, I'm going. And I asked Bob if I could go, and he said, yeah, it's only a round trip there and back. It might be overnight, or it might be 24 hours, it might be 12 hours, I couldn't remember. And so I got on, and they were building a new pole station, and they couldn't land. What was it? They were hoping to land, that was it. But they were taking big snowblowers in. So we set off, and when we got going, they were quickly known they couldn't actually land. So it was a case of what we're going to do with a snowblower. So it was decided they would put these parachutes to this snowblower and fly in low and push it out. Well, there were 7 snowblowers all together. So I think what happened, they were flying in to drop these snowblowers for this job they were doing, this new station. So anyway, they died with flying low, and they'd push this snowblower out, and he would parashoot down. I think they strapped 7 parachutes to it. So all you hear is what's coming over the radio and what you can see. You know, you're flying in low, the actual back of the plane tail drops down, and the military people push it out. And then we continue flying. The next thing you hear, the parachutes haven't opened. And this vehicle, wherever it landed, just buried itself, never to be seen again. You know, and I could just imagine, going through my mind, I thought, if that would have been British Antarctic Survey, it would have been, say, bloody hell, where's the shovels? And all that came over the radio was, OK, Mac, send the next. And that was it. You know, no panic, just get on with it, send it. Now, and that was a vast difference. You know, I think in the first instance, we wouldn't have had a snowblower. But if we'd have had one, we'd have been lucky. But after that, it would have been the shovels.
So they were better resourced?
On things like that, yeah. But not when it came to field strips.
There was no history of field work.
No, they didn't do it. You know, going to the field was unknown to them, really. So
was it a good move to go back with the Americans, or was it a bit of a...
I enjoyed it. And again, you know, when we're at... I must have flown in twice the pole, now I think about it, because I got an opportunity, a bit of a funny situation. The thing called the Minus 40s Club. To join, you're invited to join, and you have to strip off only to your boots, and you run around these markers. I think they were flags. It's supposedly at minus 40 Starkers. And that's the way you join the Minus 40s Club. That's fine, stripping off, going, running around the markers. You try to get back in, they've all closed the doors, you know, and you're stuck out, you can't get back in. So there's about 6 or 7 of us all flew or did this running around the pole or around the markers.
And that was a gag they pulled again.
Yeah, again. every time. Would you like to join the marker? Because I was called Red. I got sunburnt very easily, and I used to go literally red. And all the Americans used to say, "Hi, Red!" And where's Red?
When that term of duty with the Americans finished, you came back to the UK.
Yeah. And then I think I went again.
With the Americans?
No, with Bass.
Where to?
No, I didn't. No, that must have, the Americans must have been my, yeah, the Americans are my last trip.
Duty.
Yeah.
Did you miss it?
Did I miss the Antarctic?
Yeah.
Like mad. Yeah. I found it extremely difficult to settle back in UK.
Why didn't you go again?
My father was ill.
And
it was a family affair. My mum said, don't go.
Yeah.
Just.
So in what ways did you find it difficult to settle back in the UK?
This may sound a bit silly now. It was a world of men. And it was a world of companionship. And one of the things I learned is Hallie was a prime example. There was 26 men when I wintered at Hallie, which was big numbers. But we all depended on each other. Because what one man couldn't do, another man could. It's like with 12 films for the year at Hallie in them days. And Cat Ballou was a prime example. It was a film which, I've seen Cat Ballou at Hallie 26 times.
Jane Fonda.
Yeah, Jane Fonda, yeah.
Don't blame you.
Yeah. And you could turn the sound off completely. And what one feed did knew, and you know, if he didn't know it, somebody else would step in and say the words, you know.
Soundtrack.
Yeah, with a soundtrack by Fids. And it was just absolutely fantastic. So, you know, I always remember a funny story. There was a doctor at Hallie, Ian Peace it might have been. And he was virtually straight out of medical school and he'd got his programme to do. And he asked for three volunteers to sit in the lounge with no heat on for 5 days in clothing like we're wearing today, cold drinks, cold food. And he expected fantastic results. And he went in with us and he was, and every 4 hours he took blood samples and every 2 hours he'd take heartbeat and chest and, you know, all things like that. And one time it was my turn to have the stethoscope on me. And he's listening, and I'm tapping my back, and he looks and hears this noise, and I'm tapping away, and he's saying, and then he realised what I was doing, and he says, "Help!" And he was that cold, his teeth were chattering. He said, "Bloody hell, Paul, you've spoilt it." But he did that programme where we sat for a week or 5 days with cold food and cold whatever. Then he did one where we just sit in. Almost like a outside, but it was undercover, but outside. Again, I went in that with him, and that was part of his programme while he was down. So,
and the Fids happily joined in with
his deprivation. Yeah. He used to, he was doing something with penguins, and we used to go out to the penguin colony and collect dead penguins and lug them all the way back to the base. And then he'd thaw them out and do a post-mortem on them. The stench were awful. So, all related to either man or whatever.
There's a story about sledges on a ramp.
Oh, yeah.
Was this? Was this at Hallie?
This was at Hallie. These were sledges pulled by vehicles, big sledges. And I spoke to you about military people. Well, Ron Gill, I think his name was, he was one of the motor mechanics who thought he was the chief motor mechanic. I think he came from the army. He was a warrant officer. Couldn't cope that Fitz could. I think he was brought up in the military that you did your job because somebody with pips on the shoulders said, you do that because I'm telling you. Mm. And he found it difficult that Fitz did things because they enjoyed it and they wanted to do, and it was part of their job anyway. Anyway, one time, one of these sledges had broken and he had to be welded. So we brought this sledge in. And somebody welded it, and I had to repair some timber on it. And then there was another one, so we thought, oh, well, while there, we'll bring that one in, get that one done, get it thawed out and get it done. So we got them all done. Then the muskeg came in, reversed down the ramp. We connect them both up, and it started pulling it out. And then Ron came and started playing Merry Hell for some unknown reason, and got all upset and went into the, right at the top end of the garage was a little office, a little corner was office, and he went into his office, as he used to like to go into his office and sit in his chair. So somebody said, well, we might as well just take the pin out and we'll reverse this sledge back. Little did they know, it was quite icy on the ramp. So they pulled the pin out, this ton sledge, set off down this ramp, smashed the doors at the bottom of the garage, went straight through, full length of the garage, went through the wall of the office and just dinted the chair where Ron was sat. Well, he was furious, as somebody just come and said, I bet that bent your chair on, didn't it? It could have been a dangerous situation, you know, and that you talk about narrow situation.
Sweet, yeah.
And that was one prime example. That could have been dangerous.
Did you ever come across the Vivian Books?
Yes, I did, yeah. When I came out of Halley, oh, wow. It was one of the things I'd heard about him, obviously, and I'd read the book and whatever. And I was so pleased. I think it was his last trip before he took official retirement, shall we say. And when we went out of Halley, we went down to the old Shackleton building where he was. And it was Bransfield put a nose in, and I don't know how he got. I don't know how we got to be in the base, but whether all of us were allowed to go up to the base, certain ones went down, I don't know. But I can remember helping to dig down, and the cyclometer for telling the wind was still working on top. Anyway, we got down the base, and Sir Vivian was roaming around and recognising and telling people this and telling people that. And suddenly he bent down on the floor and picked a wooden joiner's mallet up and turned to me, and I thought, he don't know me from Adam. And he said, you're a chippy at Halley, aren't you? Take this. And he gave me the wooden mallet, and that's my prized possession even to this day. I've still got my wooden mallet that came out of...
From the IGY?
IGY, gosh. Yeah.
What did you make of him as a man?
Oh, superb. Superb. You know, I haven't had a lot to do with him, and I suppose in those days as well, as a builder, you know, if you're a scientist and you've got a programme, he wants to know about the scientific programme, but as a builder, you're just one of a team, and, you know, you just speak if you get spoken to type thing. Superb chap.
We were talking, we got digressed, that's okay. We were talking about how you felt when you came back to the UK, and you talked about the maleness of the base. Did you not miss the women at all? Did you not miss you there quite a lot in your young...
Not really, because I'd never had a girlfriend as such. Steve Wormald and Rod Pashley, who I palled about in Scouts with, they had girlfriends. So I was very fortunate. I had two girlfriends because, you know, I always used to... they were real good friends. And
So when you came back then, what was strange about being back in Britain after...
Well, having to pay for things as well.
I was a Yorkshireman.
Bit of a Yorkshireman.
I can see how that was upsetting.
And if you wanted something, it was on base. When you come back, if you want something, you hadn't got it, you had to go buy it, or you got that hassle of, where do I go, how do I get it, you know. I always remember somebody saying that the thing they experienced when they came back to England was, when they went into a pub, if there was a packet of cigarettes on the bar, they'd just help themselves to the packet of cigarettes and take one out. And somebody would say, oh, those are mine. Because on base, they were free. So anybody who smoked just helped themselves to one. And it were quirky little things. You know, you got in a car and it went 40 miles an hour. Well, you'd been in vehicles, at dogs, 2 miles an hour. And you suddenly thought, oh, what's going off here? And it was just, it was silly little things like that.
What about greenery?
Oh, well, yeah, yeah. I used to romance at the snow and the sky in Antarctica, especially at Halley, because it's just snow and
that's
sky.
All it is, yeah.
That's all it is, you know. And the sastrugi, I just if this is not sastrugi, what it's as close to you can get to it.
What, crystal glass?
On my wall.
Oh, the
some people call it dog turds.
yes, it's got a Spanish restaurant type decorations on the. What's the word for it? Snow sem.
Yeah, it's not. It's artex in lots of ways.
Artex,
it's old fashioned in lots of ways. But
patterned artex.
So, yeah.
With swirly patterns. Maybe with a piece of hardboard or something. But no, Jen, I'm sorry, we're now drifting a bit, but it's almost a final point, really, about coming back. Was it that strange? Was it that difficult?
It took a while. It wasn't strange, but it took a while. And I missed the comradeship. Mm. I missed the people I worked with. I just missed the good life, which I thought was a good life.
Was there anything that you brought back with you, inside you, from the Antarctic, which you've used in everyday life since? I mean, you set up your own business, didn't you?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
So were there any skills or qualities that you feel developed in the Antarctic that you've used again later in life?
Well, from the bottom of my heart, I think what I experienced and learned, whatever it was I brought back from the Antarctic, set the standards for what I've done the rest of my life. All right, I started a business and I had men working for me. We spoke about it. I met my wife through the business. I have a stepdaughter who I call, she's my daughter as far as I'm concerned, with two sons. They've gone into scouting. I was a local district commissioner in scouting for 9-10 years. I've taken kids abroad. Barbara only got a holiday every second year because I used to take a party of 48 kids abroad doing outdoor pursuits and adventures. So it set the scene for many, many things. I will never, ever stop thanking Bass for the opportunity they provided. I'm sorry, I'm getting a bit emotional there, but...
That's all right, you're
No, they set the scene. Yeah. They set the scene.
It was Frank, actually, wasn't it?
Frank Kelsey.
Yeah. And he gave me the advert.
Yeah. And he, unfortunately, he couldn't drive a car. It was a motorbike fiend. And he died on his motorbike, got killed on his motorbike. And, it would... I often think... And I was really saddened, and I don't know where I was, but I was saddened I couldn't attend Bill Sloman's funeral just to say thank you. Because I thought it was down to him, you know, doing what he did and doing his job quite right. So, yeah.
His life changed yours?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Very much so, yeah.
It's been fabulous, Paul. Thank you so much.